SFM Literature is indeed, it's a show, as you know, about words and writing and books and ideas. And today what we're going to do is bring you a bit of an international mix, certainly in the first hour, followed by some very local thoughts and input with all the usual regulars. So do stay tuned. Let me tell you what we've got lined up. First, in our hero bill, it's actually a double bill of internationals, going to be speaking first to Amanda Prowse. She's a UK writer, she's an army wife, and she's won herself a very far-reaching readership with her very contemporary novels. Well, we'll find out exactly what makes her tick and hear about her latest novel, which is called Will You Remember Me? Secondly, in the other half of our double bill, we'll be talking to Lebanese-born Rabbi Alameddine. Now, he lives in Beirut and San Francisco, and he talks about what it's like growing up in a city at war, and also tell us a little bit about his latest novel, which is called An Unnecessary Woman. And he was in town just recently to take part in the Open Book Festival here in Cape Town, so it'll be interesting to hear once again what he has to say. After that, in our text item, staying international, as I say, also here for the Open Book Festival, was Australian writer, he's a Guardian columnist, he's a journalist, he's a blogger, man of many skills, he's Andrew Leuvenstein. And he gives us his take on the state of being a journalist in this time of the net and all the things that go with it. After the news at 2 in our Book 2 item, The Democratic Opportunity, Does South Africa Need Electoral Reform? Well, it's a book by journalist and columnist, she's Nompumelelo Runji, who we spoke to also a little while ago on this show. She talked about being a columnist at the time, so we'll find out a little bit more about what she has to say in this more extended form of writing, where she's coming from with that. In our bookshelf, our reader for today is Robin Ausmeyer. She's a University of Cape Town gender and print journalism student who's also reading English, so I imagine her reading circle would be fairly big. We'll find out a little bit what titles she's got up her sleeve. And our story today, well, our story is the first in a two-part documentary by Nigel Famas on young jazz musicians, a new talent with a long future ahead. So do stay, if you're a jazzy, make sure that you stay with us for that one. After the news at 3, Rogers Webster has another story for us from the days of yore, waiting in the wings. And this time he's going to be telling us a little bit about shipwrecks and all the shipwrecks, the many, many shipwrecks that have run aground around the coast of South Africa. Then in our back page item, a bird book, two very well-established professionals have taken a good few years to put together The Ultimate Companion for Birding Southern Africa, and they are Peter Ginn and Jeff McKellaran. It's a double volume box set, and let me tell you, it's a real collector's item, so if you have an interest in birding, stick around for that one. That's approximately 3:15. And then last but not least, right here on SAFM Literature, to close, the Sunday Play. And don't forget, if you want to find out what's coming up on SAFM Literature, do please check our Facebook page. It's SAFM Literature. And if you want to let us know what you're reading about the book events, book clubs, festivals, launches, all the allied industries that go with booking, pop us an email. You can pop us an email on books@safm.co.za, books@safm.co.za. Or you can send me one direct if you like. It's richardsn@safm.co.za. So do stay tuned and keep reading. Just a reminder once again that the first hour of SAFM Literature is now going to be automatically podcast. So if you like a re-listen to our hero or text features, don't forget you can check the site, www.safm.co.za. So first in our two-part hero slot today, then, in this international first hour, in a minute we're going to talk to a man who spent much of his life in a city at war. But first, a woman who knows more about war, perhaps through the experience of her soldier husband. She's UK-born Amanda Prowse, who only started writing full-time about approximately 5 years ago, but who's been making up for it ever since, by the looks of it. And her latest book is called Will You Remember Me? Well, I spoke to Amanda a little earlier and I asked her if she'd always wanted to write.
Well, it is certainly something I always wanted to do, but I didn't really know if I could. And I think it's like most people that want to write a book. I was a readaholic, and I still am, and I love books and I love words. And I would often read a book and think, gosh, I can do better than that. Or I'd read a book and think, I wish I'd written that. And they kind of fell into two camps for me. And I was a management consultant for many years. And so I took the plunge in about 2010, I think it was, eventually, and said to my husband, look, you know, this is my one life. And I think I want to write stories. And he was incredibly supportive, so I gave up my job and started to write. And Poppy Day was the first book I wrote. And we self-published that book. And I was absolutely staggered. I thought maybe, you know, we might sell maybe 5,000 copies. And to date, it's sold 250,000 copies. So obviously people did quite like it, and that really gave me the confidence to go on and try another story and develop my craft. But it was one of those things, I think, if you can write, you often think you can, but it takes an awful lot of courage to put pen to paper. And I come from a very ordinary family. No one in my family had ever written a book. A lot of my family didn't read books. You know, my granddad worked in the docks all his life. My mum was a hairdresser. My dad worked on a production line of a car plant. So to say I wanted to write books was actually quite a departure for them. Some of them said, oh, don't be crazy. You know, everyone wants to write a book, but it usually doesn't go anywhere. However, I think they're all secretly quite pleased that I did decide to do it.
I bet they are now.
They are now, yes, absolutely.
So from an ordinary family, that you make it sound very humble, but I suppose it's having a, in inverted commas, an ordinary background that gives you an opportunity to talk to ordinary people, which is what most of us really like to read about, people, PLU, you know, people like us.
Yeah.
How did you start?
I think I started from looking at my own experiences. I come from a very close-knit, strong, large family, and there was a wealth of material, you know, from my grandparents, who obviously had been through World War II, living in the East End of London, watching it get bombed, and all the elements of my family, I think, that we discussed through family history, you know, people having babies, death, divorce, just everybody's ordinary lives. But actually, that's what I write about. I write about women that other women can relate to. You know, my characters are just as likely to be found standing in a supermarket queue or worrying what to give the kids for their dinner as they are anything else. And in fact, one thread that runs through all the stories is that my women, who are all ordinary but find themselves in the most extraordinary situations. And actually, if you have had quite a hard or a difficult or an interesting life, you kind of get things in your arsenal that helps you cope when those extraordinary things come along. So really, I think it's just drawing on those.
So the people that you know, I'm just thinking about you having been a management consultant. I'm not sure what sort of material you garnered then, but maybe all the people you meet one way or another come back and you can use them as material?
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very much so. Particularly being an army wife. You know, that's opened up a whole other world to me that's really given me an insight into what it's like when the man or the woman you love goes away to work for long periods of time. And the community that I live in, you know, the army community, that really helped me get started with Poppy Day, my first book, because I was writing about what it was like to have someone lost in action, pretty much.
What is it like to be an army wife? So presumably your husband is then a soldier?
Yes, he's done 30 years. I've had enough, even if he hasn't actually.
Done his thing for God and the Queen or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's an odd life, actually, and not one I'd really considered until I fell in love with a man who happened to be a soldier. But he always says that he went through years of training. But of course, when you marry the army, there isn't a manual or a guidebook on what to do. Suddenly you're at home with the kids and living in a really grotty army quarter because the accommodation is less than fantastic. And your husband's gone and you're on your own for 6 months. And it's like being a single mother for that period of time. Plus the worry of, are they going to come back safe? Are they going to come back intact? Are they going to come back changed? It's not easy, and it's a very odd life, actually.
Is there some sort of support group? Because certainly in England, you're not alone. There are a lot of army wives. There's been a lot of very unhappy stories coming out of your part of the world in terms of what's happened to soldiers. Is there a support group? Do they have people who help?
They do, but I think the best support comes on a more informal basis. It's the people you meet, you know, when you're living in camp like we do. It's the people you meet in the supermarket who'll say, do you fancy a cup of tea and how are you doing? And maybe pick up the phone if they've seen you, you know, pondering at the school gates, all that kind of thing. So it's more the informal network, I think, is of most benefit to women like me.
You know, I'm sorry to belabor this point, but it's really a very interesting one. And I'm no doubt that if there haven't already been books about it, I'm sure there will be. You know, in the old days, you mentioned your grandparents were in the Second World War, you know, when the Tommies kept letters in their top pockets, and now of course everybody's got cell phones and there's the internet, if you can get it, smartphones, whatever. What is communications like?
That's really interesting you've said that, actually, because obviously communications when you're on the front line are very, very difficult. There is a ban on cell phones and technology for obvious reasons. So my husband certainly carries letters that I've written him, photographs of our kids, things like that, that he actually keeps on his person at all times. And I think it gives him great comfort. So almost going right back to that tradition of the trenches where you had something from a loved one. And it's difficult because we get very used in the modern age to picking up the phone or sending off a text or, you know, riffling off an email. It all happens very quickly. But of course, when they're on the other side of the world and communications are slow, it can be days, weeks, and we've gone for a month, I believe, with no communication, which makes it doubly tough.
It also means that, providing that the letters come back again, it means that you will have wonderful material for your children in years to come. You know, sort of a paper trail, as it were,
absolutely,
of how things have been. Well, let's go back to your paper trail.
Yeah.
And your very first book that did so unbelievably well, and I mean, that's a real flip for anybody who's thinking of self-publishing, because, it, you know, it isn't an easy thing at all. What was it about? What was the main character? Let's start with that first.
Well, the first book was called Poppy Day, and it is the story of a lady called Poppy, who is married to Martin, a soldier. They're very young, they're in their early teens, and it's really their life together just starting out. Poppy lives in a rather disadvantaged environment, in a very grim flat in East London, in a tower block where she's grown up with her nan, her grandma, who is suffering from dementia, but has always been slightly eccentric, I would say, and her rather disinterested mum, who is more fond of the booze than she is her daughter. So Poppy kind of brings herself up, but she finds saviour in her school friend, Martin Cricket, who's the same age as her, who has a bullying father, who lives in the same environment. And they form a little club, and it does them both an incredible service. Martin says, if someone as wonderful as Poppy can love me, then maybe I'm not as stupid as I think I am. And Poppy, when she's married, constantly glances down at the little gold band on her finger and thinks, someone wanted to marry me, you know, me. And it really elevates them. Their connection makes them both feel incredibly special. The book starts with Poppy getting the knock on the door that we all dread. And she thinks instantly that Martin has been killed. He's a soldier and he's away fighting in Afghanistan. But instead she's told that Martin's been taken hostage. Now Poppy is a feisty, streetwise, smart young girl, and she feels that not enough's being done to bring him home. So she decides to go and try and bring him back herself. She hasn't got a clue how she's going to do it. She has no money, she has no resource, she's not well connected. But she's a smart girl who trusts her instinct, which is something I really believe in, trusting that feeling in the pit of your stomach. And Martin and Poppy have a connection. They say, we have heartstrings that no matter where we are in the world, time and distance can't separate us. We're joined by our heartstrings and they'll never be broken. And when people say to her, it's not looking good, we haven't heard from him, his colleague has been killed, we don't know if he's still alive, she says, he is alive, because I can feel it. I can feel him pulling on my heartstrings. She knows that he needs her to go and help him. And in a way, the book looks at that idea. I mean, we all know what it's like. If you've got children or you're married or you're close to your parents, when the person that needs you, it doesn't matter where you are in the world or what's going on, you mentally reach for those car keys. You go and help them. You go to the person that needs you when they need you the most. And that's exactly what Poppy does. She devises a brilliant way to get on a plane. She manages to make it there. And then the story unfolds from there.
And clearly you're not about to tell us what happens then. I like it that she's called Poppy Day, as in Poppy Day, as
yes,
in November the 11th.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah,
that.
Absolutely, gosh. So, well, we know for sure that Poppy comes back. We don't know anything else, but we know she comes back because she rides again in another book.
She certainly does.
And tell us your latest book.
My latest book is called Will You Remember Me? And it's the story of Poppy at 32. So we've moved on a good few years since we saw her last. She has two children, which I guess is a big clue as to whether Martin comes home or not, right? She comes home and she's living the life that she's always dreamed of. She has a small army quarter in the Wiltshire countryside amongst green rolling hills, breathing clean, fresh air, and she's loving life. Martin comes home from tour. They are just as happy as can be. It's the beginning of a new year. And the day he comes home, they lay on the trampoline in the garden, on the children's trampoline. And Martin reaches across and holds her hand and he says, it's going to be a great year, Poppy. I can feel it. And they're looking up at the stars and the kids are jumping around behind them. And she says, yep, it really is. And then very quickly after that point, Poppy discovers a lump as she discovers that she has breast cancer. And Will You Remember Me is the story of what happens when cancer comes to live at an ordinary house, knocks on the door of an ordinary family, which it does to many, many of us in our lifetime.
Hmm. Well, once again, we can only take it so far because we don't want to spoil the book entirely. But the idea of having a thread through all your books, I mean, Poppy hasn't been in all the books, has she?
She hasn't. Other characters have, yeah. Nancy. So, for example...
From the same milieu, if you like.
Exactly. Yeah. And a good example would be that in Poppy Day, Poppy's grandma, Dorothea, who's this wonderful elderly character who is sadly suffering from dementia, and we watch her decline, and it's a very tough journey to take with her. She talks about a baby that she had when she was young, and she says, "His dad, Poppy, was like sunshine to me. I loved him. He brought light into a very dark world." Poppy, of course, dismisses this as her dementia talking, and having lived with my own grandma through this very, you know, this difficult disease, it was fascinating to see some of the things that she would say and come out with, perfectly lucid and a wonderful insight. And one of the things that saddened me most about seeing my grandma with this debilitating illness in her late 80s was that the people that cared for her and looked after her only ever knew her as this person. And I thought, gosh, this is so sad, because she was a brilliant baker. She was a funny woman. She was attractive and beautiful, and she used to always put her lipstick on and, you know, stand tall and proud. And I thought it was really important to write a book that showed people prior to in the grip of this disease. And that's exactly what I did with my book Clover's Child. It talks about Dorothea's journey, and in Will You Remember Me, it turns out that Dorothea's ramblings, as Poppy thought, were actually true. She did have a baby, and it's wonderful to see that some of the things that Poppy thought were and dismissed as just talk actually come into fruition.
It seems like your own life has been more than enough fuel, you know, the personal research around dementia. Have you done any additional research? I mean, breast cancer, dementia, what next?
Well, I'm very lucky in that I do have a lot of sort of experience to call upon. I was diagnosed with cancer when I was 32. I'm now 46. I'm fighting fit, which is wonderful. And right. I think my experiences made me understand that it happens to everybody, and it happens to anybody. And certainly in the UK, lots of people talk a lot about what they'll do when they win the lottery. We all say, gosh, what am I going to do? I'll buy this house, or I'll take that trip. But we're far more likely to have a breast cancer diagnosis in our lifetime than we are win that lottery. But we don't discuss that. So I thought it was fairly good to bring it out in the open and maybe talk about it a bit more.
Yeah. You've been writing now for what? Four or five years.
And
with all these books that are all doing incredibly well, because you didn't have to self-publish for long. It was a passion. Is it now, or has it become a pressure? Do you have sort of two book deals, three book deals? How much of a pressure has it become in your life?
That's a really good question. It certainly hasn't become a pressure. I think I am the luckiest person in the world to do a job that I absolutely love and I have a passion for. I was up this morning at 6 a.m. and I think I wrote 4,000 words before, you know, 11. I still feel a hunger to write. I have 20 potential books I have synopses for that I just can't wait to get finished on, and I'm one of these people. I am terribly impatient, which is one of my biggest faults. I'm constantly looking to the next book I want to start and get that finished and done. So no, certainly not a pressure. My publishers are great. We're producing two or three books a year at the moment, which is wonderful opportunity for me. I think the day it becomes a pressure and something I stop loving will be a very sad one, because I think books are extremely important to me.
Is it a gift that you think that you were lucky enough to receive, or is it something that you can learn?
I have a gift, a God-given gift, and I'm extremely grateful for it. I don't know where my ideas come from. I don't know why it suddenly came to me that I could write a book, but the stories, the ideas, in their entirety, come into my head in about 3 to 4 minutes. And it happened to me yesterday. I got a new book. I suddenly thought, oh, I've had a great idea. So my husband got his pen and paper out and started, just made a few jotting notes. I never write a plan. I never write a note. I don't have any paper copies of anything. All my books are in my head, and I literally just bash them down. I write on a cranky, tiny computer with a small screen, so I only ever see one paragraph at a time. And the first time I see the book in its entirety is when it's printed off after the first version's finished. And then we might make a couple of changes. Pretty much that's it. That's the finished book. So I do think I'm very lucky, and I do think it's a gift. However, I do think I've got better as I go along. I think I'm learning my craft. And certainly grammar-wise and things like that, which is frankly quite rusty after, you know, it was a long time since I was in education. I think I'm learning and getting better at that, so.
Amanda Prowse, she was talking there about her latest book. It's called Will You Remember Me? But I'm sure you will remember her, but she's also a writer who invites interaction, as do in fact so many writers. So if you'd like to find out a little bit more about her, you can check her website. That's www.amandaprowse, P-R-O-W-S-E .org, amandaprowse.org. And moving away from army wives, next up we're going to be talking to a writer-painter who spent a great deal of his life in a city at war.
Breast cancer affected my whole childhood. Fear or denial could deprive your children of a mother. There are so many women desperately in need of your help. Remember, early detection saves lives.
Thanks to your support, a new mammography truck has been launched. Book now for the Pink Tie Gala Dinner and High Coffee events happening in October. For more details on how you can support this initiative, go to www.pinkdrive.co.za.
SAFM Literature with Nancy Richards.
Next up on SAFM Literature, a gentleman by the name of Rabi Alamuddin. He is a man of a number of talents. He's a writer, he's also a painter. He grew up in Beirut and now he divides his time between that city and also San Francisco. Well, he was in South Africa just a little while ago for the Open Book Festival to talk, amongst other things, about his latest book. It's called An Unnecessary Woman. It's all about a woman who is a compulsive translator and who in fact translates a whole range of writers' work, sort of upwards and downwards from Tolstoy. It followed on from his earlier bestseller, which is called The Hakawati. But this one, it's claimed, covers a whole lot of issues, including aging, politics, literature, loneliness, grief, and resilience. Well, I had the opportunity to talk to Rabi during the festival, and I asked him first briefly, tell me his story.
It's difficult to do it in a very short thing. I did all kinds of things from engineering to I got an MBA, worked as a bartender, painted, all kinds of stuff. But I've always wanted to be a writer because I have been a voracious reader since I was 3, I think. My father reminded me before he passed away that when I was 4, he asked me what I wanted to do, and I said I wanted to be a writer, and that was, at that time, my idea of being a writer was writing Superman comics. So what happened was basically just finally sitting down and writing something.
Tell me a little bit more about your father and your mother and the parents of a child who at the age of 3 is already reading voraciously. Was it something in the family?
Yes, my mother read a lot. I grew up in Kuwait in the early days, and it was really at that time just a desert. There was nothing much else to do. And kids would go out onto the streets and play, but for me it was always books. My mom would sit in one corner and read, and I would sit in another corner and read. And again, at first it was comics, so I wasn't really reading, but it's a training, basically. And it was funny because I was telling someone that I read comics in 3 languages that I did not understand. It was just beautiful to look at. But then by the age of 4 or 5, I was reading, you know, everything from Enid Blyton to, you know, Lorna Doone.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Obviously, it was an expansion on your world. Where were you born and brought up? Because you've now become a citizen of the world, but where were you born and brought up? And did the reading help you expand your view?
Oh, reading always helps expand the view. I was born in Jordan because my grandfather was a doctor there. But then, you know, I'm historically Lebanese, from a Lebanese family. My father, though, was born in Caracas, Venezuela. My mother was born in Jerusalem. Born in Jordan, I moved to Kuwait early because that's where my father was. I used to spend my summers in Lebanon. Then by the age of 10, I was sent to live with my aunt in Lebanon. By the age of 14, the war started, so I was sent to England to public school. By the age of 17, I went on my own to the USA and went to college. Moved back to Lebanon, then went back to the US for my graduate degrees. And I've been living between Lebanon and San Francisco since.
It's quite a lot of history packed into a very short space of time. And I'm thinking that your book, your latest book, An Unnecessary Woman, is also a huge amount of history and a huge amount of a lot of what's constituted your life, all put together. Can you, again, briefly, just give me the synopsis?
The synopsis. It's about a 72-year-old woman who begins the book with blue hair, accidentally died. But it's about a recluse who is not really part of society, and she reads a lot, so her world is through literature, and she sees and filters life through literature, and the world has not much use for her because she's elderly, she's unmarried, no kids, so society really doesn't know what to do with her, and it's about her life, 3 days in her life.
And nor does she need society, by the sounds of it. She is surrounded by gossip mongers, by people who want things from her, not least her own home. So she's surrounded, but she has managed to sort of block them out.
Yes, it's her way of surviving, basically. She has created a life. And, you know, she lives in her apartment. She used to work in a bookstore and basically run it. And she translates books in her spare time. She has figured out a long time ago that she had no use for people, whether it was her choice or society's choice is left up to the reader.
She translates upwards and downwards from Tolstoy and left and right and everything. It feels like this may be something you know. Have you done such a thing?
I have never translated, no. But I have read the books that she's translated. So for me, yes, I sometimes say jokingly, although it's not much of a joke, that even though she's 72-year-old recluse with blue hair, this is probably the most autobiographical novel I've written, and that a lot of her feelings are mine. I sometimes say that, you know, she is who I aspire to be, someone who, with all that life has given her, not only manages to have a rich life, but to have a life that is by her rules, by her standards. She decides what is important for her, irrelevant of what other people think, and I would love to get to that stage.
Interestingly, however, she does all these translations, and yet she squirrels them away in a room that nobody should see. She doesn't send them to publishers. Nobody gets to clap eyes on them. I imagine that's where the similarities perhaps end.
Yes. I mean, I, in some ways, that's what I say I aspire to be, because I still want to be read and acclaimed. I do some of the things that she does. You know, a lot of my art projects these days, I just don't show to anybody. I do them just for me. I mean, who knows what will happen? But the whole idea of doing something by one's standards that are not open to public scrutiny or public acclaim in the world we live in now, where everything is so dependent on visibility and fake fame and, you know, celebrities, is a really tremendous achievement, I think. I mean, granted, maybe there's this whole discussion throughout the novel as to whether this is her decision or society's decision, but that she does these translations for no one else but her own standards and her own pleasure, to me, is one of life's greatest achievements.
The other thread that's in the book is that it's all about life within a city at war. And I think somewhere you describe that what it must be like to go to a society where you can turn a light on and everything is very normal. Are you very familiar with life in a city at war, and how has that affected your writing?
Well, I am from Beirut, and I live in Beirut part of the year and the other in San Francisco. So, yes, I just came back from Beirut, where we don't really have electricity these days. So it's a big deal to understand what we take for granted. And I don't mean the sort of the disparity in income or anything like that. What I mean by that is that in places where you take things for granted, like the U.S. or, you know, she talks about London or Germany, the trouble is that we begin to assume that this is what life is, that life is predictable, that we can control life. And the truth is, and she talks about it as she starts aging, that she can't control anything about her body anymore. You know, it behaves in ways that are uncontrollable. So that she wonders and asks the question, does getting old in a place like Lebanon, where nothing is predictable, drain you to the aging process? You know, where you go to a, you know, place like Berlin or London, and when everything works, and then all of a sudden your body stops working or behaving the way it should be, does it come as a surprise?
Just lastly, you're an artist. You're also producing artworks as well as writing books. Is one a relief from the other? Do you use your art or writing sort of alternately to give your either side of your brain a break?
No, I don't think so. The trouble for me is I'm kind of a writer that's somewhat obsessive, and the same with my, whatever I do for art. So I do something because I'm obsessed about doing it, and it's on my mind constantly. I don't think one relieves the other. Maybe actually they exacerbate each other, and then I go to therapy.
That was Rabi Alameddine, Lebanese-born author of An Unnecessary Woman, amongst many other books and many other artworks, as you heard. And just a reminder that he was in town once again here in Cape Town for the Open Book Festival that took place last month. We're also here for the Open Book Festival in this first international hour with a gentleman by the name of Anthony Leuvenstein. He's an Australian independent freelance journalist. He also writes a column for The Guardian. He's a blogger and he's an author of a number of books, amongst them one called Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. Intriguing title, that. Well, I had the opportunity to speak to Anthony as well, and I asked him when his writing career began.
I started writing, I guess, as a professional journalist about 12 years ago, and I got a traineeship, which is like a cadetship for a newspaper in my country, the Sydney Morning Herald online. And I think for me, I came into journalism at a time where the internet was really taking off as a medium. So I suspect if I'd been around 20, 30 years ago, my success or my work wouldn't have had the same kind of traction. I only say that because I think there is a general conservatism when it comes to points of view in a lot of the press. Of course, I'm generalizing. There are exceptions in every country, including here in South Africa, I know. But generally speaking, I think the web has allowed a greater diversity of voices, more what I would call dissenting voices to challenge, whether it's typical views on the Middle East or capitalism or whatever it may be. So my path was unconventional. I started writing critically about Israel-Palestine. I'm Jewish, although I'm an atheist Jew, and I was very critical about how Israel treats the Palestinians, and that's only increased over the last 10 years in my work. It's one side of my work, and that got a lot of attention. A lot of people were very upset, especially in the Jewish community in my country and also in the UK and elsewhere, and that's really in some ways continued, where I think it's gave me an opportunity to say that I'm a human being first and a Jew second. And yet, when it comes to the issue of Israel-Palestine, I think a lot of Jews check out their morality when they're talking about the issue because they believe in tribalism before what I would call human rights of the Palestinians. So, it's been an interesting journey.
Yeah. And part of the journey, I suppose, is a twofold journey, because one can hone one's skills as a writer, but one also has to hone one's opinion and one's critical thought. And I have to be very sure about what you're saying, and clearly your sureness has transmuted itself to other people who now believe you and sort of say, okay, you can fill us a column. You know, which has been more difficult, the writing or the opinion forming?
I think I will start my answer by saying that I think there's a myth that journalism is objective, that the best journalists, obviously everyone has their own view, and that's the nature of being human, but people, I'll argue, I think many more conservative journalists, that you leave those opinions at the door, that you go and you write a story, you write obviously an opinion piece is different to a news story. I think that's a myth. I think it's a complete myth. But generally, those people who say that are defaulting to a very business as usual approach. So someone who is less critical about, for example, the Middle East will more likely take a position supportive of Israel because that'll get you into less trouble, it's more mainstream, it's more acceptable. I don't think all my work is simply an opinion. I mean, a lot of my work is investigative from a particular issues, whether it's, as I said, bloggers or dissidents in repressive regimes who are online, who are on Facebook, who are blogging, who are tweeting. And that's, of course, been a really important issue in the last 3 years since the Arab Spring, which has now turned pretty ugly, you'd have to say, in the Middle East. But nonetheless, a lot of those voices, the people who were the loudest, who were the strongest, who were critical of the Mubarak regime in Egypt, for example, had a history before the revolution of being critical online, particularly in the streets as well. I don't want to suggest that, and this often I think is a Western myth, that people go on Facebook and therefore there's a revolution the next day. That's bollocks, frankly. There is a lot of online activism which complements other kinds of work. But I think for me, I don't leave my opinions at the door, and it doesn't mean that I want to ram it down people's throats. Some agree and some don't, and I think I would argue that I'm more honest about it than other journalists who claim to not show their opinions so much. And often I get into heated but friendly arguments with other journalists and writers in general, who sometimes believe that you need to give the illusion of objectivity. To me, you need to be fair. Balance is a myth as well. You need to be fair to your issues, to your subject. And to me, when, for example, we talk about Israel-Palestine, there are not two equal sides. One side's occupied and one is not. I'm not saying that Israelis haven't got humanity. Of course, they're human beings as well. But ultimately, the Palestinians are under occupation. They have been now for more than half a century. That's a disparity in power, clearly. And to me, our responsibility as humans and as journalists should be, I think, to highlight the stories of those who are less powerful, and that clearly on that issue are the Palestinians.
I would like to get on to your authorship in just a minute, but just staying with the blogging and the journalism and the columns, now more than ever, there's a lot of interaction with readers, one that was not able to hide behind the skirts of your editor anymore. There's a lot of coming and going and toing and froing. Do you enjoy that? Do you handle it? How does it work for you?
I definitely embrace it. Again, I have a real issue with journalists who resent it. I think ultimately, journalists are not speaking from the mountain as a voice of God. You know, there was this sense, I think, years ago that a journalist puts out a column in the morning in the newspaper, which it was back in the day, and that was the gospel, that was it, and then you move on and write your next piece the next day or the next week. This is a deeply problematic relationship. I think, yes, I'm often overwhelmed with comments, some positive, some very hateful. I've received hate mail, death threats over the years, particularly over work I've done in relation to, I guess you'd say, sort of war on terror related stuff post 9/11 and Israel-Palestine. But no, I'm very active on Facebook, on Twitter. I engage with people. I never really respond to people who send me hate mail. But what I do, and this is something I got from a very well-known writer in the US, a Jewish writer who's rights critical, is that he publishes the hate mail he gets with their email address. Almost as a way of saying, okay, you have the right to be hateful. I mean, it's a free world, sort of. But the way I'm going to deal with this is I think people need to see what you get if you write like that, if you are critical. So I don't really, I guess, engage with those people per se. It's more showing to the world. And I think a lot of people, it's published on my website under a letters section that I published over the years, hundreds of these kind of emails from individuals, most of whom I don't know, they're strangers. But in a more positive way, all of my work, and I often thank these people in the credits, acknowledgements in my books, have provided amazing amounts of information, links, insights, contacts, friendship, and that is something I think any writer should welcome. I certainly do, and I think I'm glad I live in a time where it's not simply my editor who I interact with. I think it's great.
You know, I understand what you're saying about the hate mail, but are you influenced by the interactions that you get? I mean, do you find your own opinion changing, thinking, oh, they could be right, this is something different?
My views have been challenged, for sure. I think when it comes to, say, Israel-Palestine, I guess, after all the hate mail, suddenly think, oh, yes, the occupation is good. I certainly haven't gone down that path. But on other issues, yes, I guess my mind has been opened. I think one of the mistakes that many of us have who write on politics in journalism is that we pretty much too often read just what we agree with. And there's a sense, I think, a lot of people, when they look at the internet in general, a lot of studies have shown this, particularly in the US, but I'm sure it's the same in other countries around the world. People often go online, or they go to TV, or they go to print to read stuff that mostly confirms their own bias. And of course, I do that to some extent too. We all do. But I really try to make a big effort to read a lot of material that I fundamentally oppose. This could be articles, analysis, books. I think we need to be aware of what other people say who disagree with us. It's sort of an obvious thing to say in a way, but I think a lot of writers don't do that. I'm obviously speaking here as a journalist rather than just, you know, someone who's just an author or novelist. That's, I guess, a bit different. I can't speak so much on that, but yes, I think I've learnt also how to hone my own arguments, maybe knowing what the opposing view is going to say, what they're likely to argue. And I think ultimately, on, say, the Palestine issue just briefly, what's happened in the last 10 years, and obviously I've played a very small part in this, but global public opinion is undeniably shifting on this question. There's no doubt about that, that the powers that be politically are still fairly uncritical towards Israel and will support its behaviour, no matter how criminal or violent it is. But I think public opinion, including here in South Africa, with its connection to apartheid and the history that you have here, undeniably has changed in the last decade to be far more open to critical views. And I think I hopefully have played a small part in that.
Just in terms of authorship, you talk about just a novelist, just an author. Have you written novels? Or forgive my ignorance if you have. Have you written novels? And if so, how do you feel about working with fiction?
I have not, is the short answer. Not a novelist. I started writing a book many years ago, a fiction book, which I'm sure was bloody awful in hindsight. But no, I've written a number of investigative journalism books, a number of books, some of which have done very well, some are bestsellers, some less so. I would like, there's a side of me that likes to imagine I could write fiction one day. I don't see it if I die one day and I haven't written fiction, it'll be a failure of my life, but at the moment it's not a priority or focus. And I think one thing which I would like to do more, but I just don't do, I don't really read fiction now at all. And I think that's probably not good for my understanding, my education. I read massive amounts of information every day. I'm reading articles, books, huge amounts of material from all over the world. But it's not just journalism or, you know, hard news. It might be analysis or essays or whatever it may be, but not generally fiction. And my understanding is a lot of journalists are in that same boat, and that's probably not a good thing. Is that going to change? Well, maybe, hopefully, one day. But yeah, let's see. Hold that thought.
If anybody would like to read more of what you said, you mentioned your website. What is your website?
My website's antonylowenstein.com. So AntonyLowenstein, just .com. People will find that. I'm very active on Twitter, so people can just at Ant Lowenstein, AntonyLowenstein. And they can go to The Guardian, where I write a weekly column on international politics.
And that was indeed Antony Lowenstein. And as you heard there, if you'd like to read a little bit more about what he has to say and be interested in his take on the world and politics, not least the Palestine-Israeli conflict, check his site. It's AntonyLowenstein.com, AntonyLowenstein.com. And you're listening to SAFM Literature, coming to you from Cape Town. So do stay with us. We've got two more hours to go of books and words and ideas. So, as I say, stay with us.